Good afternoon. My name is Daniel Inger. I'm 56 years old. Today is June 26th, 2018, and we're at Thomasville Heights Elementary School in Metro Atlanta in Georgia, and I have the pleasure of being here with the principal, Mr. Miles. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Jovan Miles, and I'm 37 years old.
Mr. Miles, I'm grateful for this chance to sit down with you. I'm really looking forward to what you have to say in this recording, and I'd like to start with a real doozy of a first question, namely, tell me the story of your life from the time you were a little boy up to the present day.
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, I'm 37 years old. I was born in the Bronx, New York, 1981, January 10th. If you let my mother tell it, I was born in the middle of a blizzard, and I was a big baby. My mother was 15 years old when I was born. And when I reflect on, you know, my childhood and those early years in New York, I like to jokingly tell people I had, you know, every ghetto stereotype you can think of in my house. So, you know, my mom, teenage mother, I had an uncle who was a drug dealer, a grandfather who was an addict, in and out of the house. You know, he was physically abusive to my grandmother. there were five or six of us, you know, living in a two-bedroom walk-up in the Bronx. And, you know, those early years, I think back on them fondly, you know, because we were such a close-knit family. We were all together. We were all in one place. But, you know, looking at those early years through the lens of an adult, I can see how toxic, you know, an environment it was to kind of grow up in. You know, the things that so those are my early years. And one of the things that I really remember about growing up is you know, my relationship with school. You know, the home neighborhood was what it was. I would go outside and play. I'd get in trouble. My mother and grandmother were not pleased with me running around with the neighborhood kids and doing everything I could in the neighborhood. And I remember going to a private daycare center for preschool, and I had a teacher named Miss Eleonora. And Miss Eleonora was one of the first Southern ladies I'd ever met in my life. You know, she refused to call me Jovan. She always called me Jovan. But Miss Eleonora was always very attentive. She pushed me very hard. She didn't accept me messing around and playing. And I remember that, you know, as a five-year-old kid, I remember this woman and how she treated me and what she expected of me. You know, the only time I went to public school in the Bronx was for kindergarten. Went to kindergarten. I can't remember my kindergarten teacher's name, but I do remember giving that woman a hard time. if you let my mother and grandmother tell it, I was a bright kid, but I was very easily bored. And, you know, the Bronx in the 80s was what it was. You know, I wasn't getting the best education, you know, at PS, whatever it was. So my mother and grandmother did what they had to do to get me a scholarship to a local Catholic school, Holy Spirit Catholic School. I remember that. And I went there for first grade and second grade. And, you know, it was a place that was safe. It was safer than my neighborhood. I didn't have to worry about, you know, fighting or anybody taking things from me or bums or junkies or anything like that. It was just a place where I could go and be a kid. And I was pushed academically, and it was a place where it's probably one of the first places where I felt like I could shine. You know, my mother being so young, I was the first grandchild, so I got all of that attention, and my grandmother always made me feel special, and my aunts and uncles always made me feel special by virtue of the fact that I was the only one, you know. But in the neighborhood, I just felt like one of a million other kids. And it wasn't until I would go to school where I felt like, okay, there's something, you know, special about me, or there are people here that made me feel special or made me feel important. And they expected a lot of me. So, you know, even in, you know, first and second grade, school became a place where I fit in, like it felt right. You know, I mentioned that my mother was a teenager, you know, when I was born, and my father, my biological father, I never really had a relationship with him. I remember meeting him or being in the space with him once. You know, he came to the neighborhood, wanted to buy me a toy out of the corner store, and my mom wouldn't let him because, you know, he wasn't doing much else. So that was probably the one and only time, the one and only memory I have of him. My mother later met and married, you know, the man I refer to as my father. I was maybe 6 or 7 when they met. And at that point, so it was around, what, second grade, the end of second grade, they had, you know, gotten engaged and decided to enter into a serious relationship. And we moved out of my grandmother's place and moved into a place of our own on the Grand Concourse in the Bronx. And, you know, having had such a positive experience at Holy Spirit, they didn't want to send me to the neighborhood school again. So my dad, he's actually got a really good friend who spent some time living in the Bronx, and he went to a private school there called Melrose Community School. So I was enrolled in Melrose Community School after we moved into this new apartment building. And again, it was another one of those places where I kind of got to shine. You know, school was just my thing. Like, it just made, it always made sense for me. I understood the rules, the spoken and unspoken rules. I just understood how to be successful in that space. And it was always a really, really safe space for me where, you know, life outside of school wasn't necessarily that safe. My parents being so young, they worked very hard. You know, my mother and father were both going to school at night. They were working full time during the day. So that left me to be raised, you know, by the community. We jokingly refer to me as a community baby. You know, my grandmother, my great aunt, my cousins, my uncles, my aunts, I would kind of be shuffled from one person to the next, you know, in the evenings after school, which was great. But, you know, you're asking young people to look after a young person, and I would go outside and get into my own stuff, and that stuff wasn't necessarily safe, you know. So again, yeah, school was the constant for me. School was the safe space for me. And I did well in school. I just always did well. I love to read, you know, as a kid, you know, comic books, the encyclopedia, National Geographic magazine my grandmother would buy me, all of those things. You just sit that in front of me and I would just be lost in it, you know, for hours. So yeah, those are those early years. And that was up until about age 10, you know. At age 10 or 11, my mother, she was working for IBM at the time. She'd gotten an internship while she was in college and was one of the first, you know, black women to get into IT in the mid to late 80s. You know, you didn't see that very often. So her job gave her an opportunity to transfer her entire department down to Atlanta. So I remember my parents taking trips to Atlanta, you know, staying with my aunt and uncle who lived in the SWATs at the time. And they would just come down here and look for houses and look for neighborhoods to, you know, send me to school and all of that. And eventually they found a place in Stone Mountain. And we moved in June or July of 91, maybe 92. And it was like a culture shock for me. You know, I was a city kid. You know, I'm used to taking the bus. I remember taking the bus, you know, by myself as a 7-8-year-old kid, just getting on the city bus, going wherever I needed to go. I was a latchkey kid. You know, it was the 80s in the Bronx. So like you would see needles and crack vials just around. Like that was my normal. And then to go from that and literally 2 hours later, you know, we're in Stone Mountain, Georgia, which to me felt like Mayberry. It was super suburban, lush green lawns. You know, we moved into, the house was new construction in an older neighborhood. So it was just really, really, I felt like we hit the lottery. You know, I'd never experienced anything like it. And one of those earliest memories for me was, you know, after we moved into the house, I remember standing in the driveway and, you know, the neighbors would drive up and down the street. We lived at the top of the hill and people would just wave and say hello. And I thought it was the craziest thing in the world. Like, I don't know you, you don't know me. Why are we speaking to each other? You know, it's just not a thing that was done where I was from. But I don't know, I quickly got used to the space, you know, having a front yard and a backyard, being able to ride the bike up and down the street. I was a little upset that first summer because it was like 3 weeks long. We moved so late in the year and the school year starts a lot earlier down here in Georgia. So I was a little upset about that. But overall, it felt, like I said, it felt like we won the lottery. Like life changed really quickly for me overnight. And then I enrolled in public school again. Again, so fifth grade was the first time I'd been in public school since kindergarten. I was super excited. I get to wear my own clothes at school again. You know, took the school bus. I was like, okay, great. I'm a normal kid again, is what it felt like, because I got out of the uniforms and all of that. But I wasn't very successful back in that first year in public school. Coming from New York to Atlanta and being kind of a bookish and quiet kid anyway, I think I was ahead academically in some ways. And this is before, this is years before it was like, okay, meet kids where they are, differentiate instruction and all of that good stuff. You know, if a kid finished early, he was expected to just kind of be quiet and occupy him or herself and not get anybody else in trouble, that kind of thing. And I did the exact opposite. You know, if I finished work early, I'm like, okay, well, I want to talk to my buddies or I want to play with my buddies. And, you know, that was kind of my way of being in school in fifth grade. And then being a northerner coming to, I don't know, I wouldn't call it the deep south, but Stone Mountain was different in the early 90s as compared to now. You know, back then Stone Mountain was a lot more racially mixed. I remember in the neighborhood, you know, we had black neighbors, white neighbors. You know, it was just really, really racially mixed. As a kid going to school, that was, I think, that was probably the first time I'd ever had a white teacher. And our relationship was, it was adversarial. You know, I was a smart aleck, and I was bored. And I was from New York, so I had all of these things going on. And I'm 10, 11 years old, right? So I've got an ego, I'm from someplace else. You know, I probably was feeling myself a little bit, but that teacher and I did not have the greatest relationship. And, you know, I went from being literally a straight A student to pulling C's in fifth grade. You know, fifth grade's not that hard, right? So if you're pulling C's in fifth grade, it's, I don't know. I can't remember what I was doing to get C's. I think I may have just been bored and just not doing the work, but, you know, the teacher sat down with my parents at a conference and tried to suggest that, you know, I had ADD or that maybe I needed to be tested for special ed. Like, it was not a positive meeting between my parents and that teacher. And that was it for me with that school. You know, I finished up the school that year, you know, and it was my neighborhood school. But my parents, again, you know, did what they did in New York. So just like in New York, I had a bad experience in kinder. They found other ways for me to get access to a quality education. They looked into the M2M programming from DeKalb County years ago and the magnet programming. And I was able to get into the magnet program. So I went from, you know, living in Stone Mountain, going to elementary school in Stone Mountain, to, you know, getting up 2 hours earlier, riding a bus or riding two buses really to go to school in Decatur. And, you know, Decatur's a 15-minute drive, you know, from Stone Mountain, but you've got all of these kids and they don't all live in the same place. So, you know, a lot of early mornings, a lot of late evenings. But I got into a magnet program in in Decatur, and it was a place where I was challenged again. You know, it was a public school, but they weren't necessarily putting up with my crap. You know, so the smart alecky New York, I'm better than you attitude, you know, that lasted about a week in that place. And it was a math and science magnet program. And that was at Canby Lane Elementary in Decatur. School's still there. I don't think it's still a magnet program anymore. But I was really turned on by the math-science angle. I mentioned earlier, I'm a bookish kid. I love to read, or I was a bookish kid. I still think of myself as that same person. But math was something you just did because you had to do it. It wasn't necessarily a passion for me. But I got into, briefly, you know, I got into math. I got into science. I got into engineering. I remember a field trip to Georgia Tech, and that was the first college campus I had visited in Atlanta. You know, my mother, like I mentioned earlier, when we were in New York, she was in school while she was working, and she went to, I guess, the equivalent of a community college. Same thing with my dad. So I'd go to campus with her every once in a while, but I'd never experienced campus life like the kind you see on television with dorms and rolling greens and, you know, like a student union. And, you know, I went to Georgia Tech and it changed my life. You know, it was sixth grade when I decided, okay, I'm going to college, you know. And it was Georgia Tech because that's the only place I'd ever been, you know. So one of the things they really pushed in that program was, you know, your grades had to be right to get into a place like Tech. So then I started taking school seriously again. You know, Canby Lane ran through seventh grade. And back in those days in DeKalb County, high school began in eighth grade. So you didn't get any credits, but the eighth graders were in the same building as, you know, freshmen up through seniors. So I stayed in the magnet program through high school. I went to Columbia High School, also in Decatur, also a math science magnet program. And, you know, in eighth and ninth grade, honestly, I kind of lost interest in academics. I think girls were the new focus of my attention in eighth and ninth grade. I know. You know, it's the first time you're in building with at that time what felt like grown women to me. Like these seniors walking around were like goddesses, right? So I said to myself, all right, I'm not very athletic, right? So how do I get to know these goddesses of the high school? And I joined the band. I was a band student in elementary school. I played the trumpet. But I joined the marching band. You know, at that time, to me, the most beautiful girls in the school were, you know, the dancers in the band and the majorettes. And it was like, okay, this is a way to kind of get to know them. The band ended up being another avenue that connected me to the college experience or the academic experience. My band director was a graduate of Morris Brown. And, you know, half the time, you know, we'd be learning to play a new piece of music, but the other half of the time he would be talking to us about his college experience and really just making it attractive, you know, making it something that, you know, as a black kid from the Bronx or from Decatur or wherever, that college was an eventuality. You know, it wasn't a choice. It wasn't an option. It's like, okay, this is what you do. You know, you finish high school, you go to college, you start a career, you have a family, like you do the whole American dream. And I got that from, you know, that visit to Georgia Tech in sixth grade. And we went multiple times, but that first visit in sixth grade and then eighth grade through 10th grade, just that constant reinforcement from my band director. And kids he sent to college on band scholarships would come back and talk to us about what it was like. And it was just like, okay, well, this is just what you do. You know, you finish school, you go to school again, right? So again, school kind of became the constant in my life. You know, I did well in high school, got the Hope Scholarship here in Georgia, and by the time I graduated, I'd lost interest in mathematics and engineering and science and that kind of thing, and I went to Georgia State University. And, you know, I went to Georgia State, and like many 18-year-olds deciding what to do for the rest of their lives, I had no idea why I was there, you know. I was a psychology major for a little while. You know, I thought, okay, I'll do psychology and then do law school afterward. One of my roommates was, you know, really great with computers, and then I was a computer information science guy. And, you know, by the end, I was just ready to get out. So I just declared business as my major, you know, graduated with a business degree. After graduation, while I was in college, I worked full-time, you know, just like my parents, in banking. And I thought, you know, while I was working in banking, I'm thinking, okay, well, I can do this, right? I'll go into finance and be a captain of industry and make all the money in the world. But doing that work, it turned me off because it reduced people to numbers, right? People weren't their stories. People were their account balances or the value they brought to the bank. And I mean, that's business, that's capitalism, sure. But that kind of left a sour taste in my mouth. Like, I didn't want to spend the rest of my life doing that. So I graduated, and I'm just working and just kind of floating through life. And this is, I don't know, a few months after graduation, you know. I graduated at the end of the summer. My mom says, you know, I know somebody who runs an after-school program. Why don't you give it a shot? And I said, okay. So I worked in the after-school program with kids in first and second grade. And at that point, I didn't even know if I liked working with little children. But I loved it. And I was just kind of off to the races at that point. I was like, okay, so how do I become a teacher? And I don't know, maybe 8 months after working in that after school program, I get into an alternative teacher prep program, and I start teaching in Atlanta public schools. You know, so I taught for 5 years in APS. I was an instructional coach for 4 years. I worked for the State Department of Education for about 2 years, and I've been here at Thomasville as an administrator going on 3 years. So, you know, first couple of years here as the assistant principal and now as principal. And, you know, I reflect on my life and, you know, why did I decide to become an educator, right? Some people are just like, oh, it's a calling, and they've known they wanted to do it forever. And I didn't know that I wanted to do this for the rest of my life until, you know, working in an after school program. But when I look back on what was consistent for me, it all makes sense. You know, school was always that constant in my life, that safe haven, the place that made me feel, you know, welcome. It made me feel like anything was possible. The experiences I had in school as an elementary school kid, as a high school kid, showed me that there was more in the world than, you know, where I came from. So now here at Thomasville, I think about my early beginnings, you know, the every ghetto stereotype in the house. And those are the kids we serve, you know, the same types of exposure that I had as a young kid to, you know, substance abuse, to, you know, teenage pregnancy, to absentee parents, to, you know, proximity to drugs and alcohol. Like, that's the normal for my kids. So I'm invested in this place because I know how life-changing a quality education can be. I also know that left unchecked, you know, one teacher can completely derail the possibilities for a kid. I think back to that fifth grade teacher that I had who because I was being a smart aleck, and that's really what it was. I was being a smart alecky kid. I was probably a little arrogant. You know, all of that is true. You know, I was not a great student for her, but she had kind of written me off in a way that if my parents didn't know how to advocate for themselves, she could have used that power that she had. And, you know, it was a little bit of power, but she could have used that power to completely change the trajectory of my life. And that's a lot of responsibility in the hands of a teacher, of educators. So that's something I try to communicate to my team here. You know, our kids come in the door with a lot of challenges and a lot of baggage and not the best behavior in the world, and they can push your buttons. But, you know, I think back to me and I look at them and I'm like, they have all the possibility in the world. You know, we just need to remain patient with them and try to find that hook, that lever, to get them thinking about their life outside of their neighborhood and outside of this school.
Mr. Miles, Thomasville Heights Elementary School is lucky to have you with all of your life experience and the way that you bring that to the school here. You spoke a little bit, or quite a bit actually, about the community that your children come from. Imagine that somebody comes from far away. Somebody comes to Atlanta and they walk into Thomasville Heights area. They come from Germany or Guatemala or China, and they run into you and they say, "Excuse me, sir, could you tell me, please, what actually is this area? What's this community like? What's this neighborhood like? How would you describe Thomasville Heights to an outsider?"
That's a good question. I think I'd begin by letting them know that the community is very close-knit. The people here care deeply about one another. They have long-standing ties to the area, and it's not uncommon to find several generations of families who live in the apartment complex that kind of makes up the majority of the folks who live here. That aside, I would also say that the community is in need. You know, these folks lack access to things that I take for granted in my own personal life. You know, the nearest institution to the school is, to the neighborhood rather, is the school on one end and the federal prison on the other end. Within a 5-mile radius, we have there's a landfill that's not far, a juvenile detention center. You know, there aren't a lot of people who own cars in the neighborhood, so I'd categorize it as a food desert. You know, members of the community lack access to, you know, fresh fruit and vegetables, healthy choices for the kids to eat. In many ways, I'd describe the area as neglected by the city. And that goes for the streets. When you drive up the street to get to the school or to the neighborhood, there's potholes, the streets are uneven. Many of the folks who live here are pedestrians, but there are not a lot of trash receptacles for people to just, you know, throw away their water bottles or their potato chip wrappers. So you'll see a lot of trash on the ground. But then there's the parks, where on any given day, the parks are full of kids. There's the pool, same thing. The pool is going to be full of kids. There's the Boys and Girls Club. There's Thomasville Heights Elementary School, where kids who could choose to just hang out all summer and do what I would have done, you know, as a kid and just kind of run around the neighborhood, they choose to, you know, knock on the door and come see the front office staff or to come see me, or if they see their teacher's car pull in the parking lot, they will come in the parking lot and just visit with a teacher. So it's a neighborhood that's full of contradictions, you know. People care about the neighborhood. The residents want the best for themselves and for their children. But then you have a subset of those residents who I think are probably a loud minority who actively do damage to the neighborhood. So yeah, it's a collection of contradictions, this place.
Mr. Miles, imagine you have the possibility to sit down one-on-one with an influential leader here in Atlanta, maybe a mayor or somebody from the county, and you have a chance to share with that person your thoughts on what leaders here just aren't getting, what they're not understanding about Thomasville Heights. I often think oftentimes our leaders are well-intentioned, but just because they lack certain personal experience in some neighborhoods, they don't get it right. What are people not getting about Thomasville Heights?
Well, there's a litany of things that people are not getting about Thomasville, but I'm gonna focus on three that, you know, weigh heavily on my mind when I do my visits to the neighborhood. First is just the physical state of the apartment complex that houses most of the residents. It's nothing short of criminal, you know, what that space looks like. Externally, it's old, it's outdated. There are buildings where the awnings are falling off, the roofing is coming off. When you talk to the residents, they complain of mold, of vermin, of rats living in the walls. You know, and it's hard to take pride in where you live when, you know, you're paying rent to folks who are not managing the upkeep of the space. It's hard to be a kid who goes home and you tell that kid, hey, pick that, you know, candy wrapper off the ground, when they turn over their shoulder and they look at a building that's falling apart and that's where they sleep every night. So updating or just basic upkeep of the physical space is a biggie for me. I think community policing is important. You know, I ask my faculty to walk kids home in the afternoons because I mentioned earlier the kids bring a lot of challenges into the building with them. And sometimes those challenges from one kid or a cohort of kids can be a lot. And then, you know, teachers, that empathy meter becomes drained, you know. So I say, hey, walk a kid home. Remember what it is that they're facing, that they walk through every day to get here and to go home, to kind of remind yourself why you need to be the constant and why you need to be patient and why you always need to be willing to give them a second, third, fifth, tenth chance. So I do that myself. And one afternoon I was walking two kids home, pair of brothers, one was in first grade, one was in third. And we were just walking up the street, broad daylight. And the neighborhood is overrun by gangs and by drug sellers. So we were walking past a group of guys that were hanging out in one of the parking lots. And I witnessed what I thought was, you know, a hand-to-hand drug exchange. And the guys weren't paying us any mind. I mean, they see me in the neighborhood all the time. They see the staff in the neighborhood all the time. But as I walked past the guy, I saw the handle of a pistol hanging out of his pants. You know, and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's broad daylight, it's a public street in an American city, the capital city, right? And my kids have to walk past that every single day. You know, the parents who live in the neighborhood have to, I imagine, live in fear of retaliation if they, you know, complain to the authorities about what's going on. And the police come to the neighborhood, but they come after something has happened. You know, so I would love to walk kids home and see police on foot, you know, not harassing folks, but just old school community policing where, you know, it's a high crime area. You know, there are gangs, you know, there are drugs. And instead of coming after someone has been shot or after a crime has been committed, you are there on foot, talking to people, building relationships with kids, building relationships with parents, building relationships with the churches and the school. And I mean, just doing community the way that we know community should be done. So that would be a biggie. And then last but not least, get rid of the federal prison. You know, I've got students who, when they look out of their bedroom window, they see barbed wire and then they see the federal prison. It's hard to imagine what's possible when you live in the shadow of the prison and your neighborhood is overrun with crime and it's falling down around you. I mean, I can only imagine it's got to feel like no one cares. You know, kids have to feel that. Adults have to feel that. They've got to feel that. So, yeah, if I could do anything, those would be the three things that I would start with. Community policing, fixing up the physical spaces where the kids and the families go to sleep at night, and getting rid of that federal prison. Shouldn't be in the city limits. It shouldn't be that close to residential.
Mr. Miles, imagine for a moment, please, that you're a millionaire. And you're a millionaire with a big heart. You'd like to spend $1 million in the Thomasville Heights area to make life safer for people here. I know you were speaking a moment ago about community policing. Can you either say a few more words about that or share some other ideas about what you would do to make the area safer?
Sure. So as I said earlier, I think community policing would go a long way to begin making the Thomasville Heights or Thomasville Heights community safer, and the Forest Cove apartment complex in particular. But in addition to that, you know, right on McDonough Boulevard, it's one of the main thoroughfares that runs, you know, near the community. Kids, grandmothers, you know, pregnant moms, dads walking with their kids, they just kind of walk up and down the street there. And to one side of them, it's just tons of overgrown brush where people just kind of hang out. You walk by and it's not safe for kids. Somebody could, you know, jump out and grab one of the kids. But on the other side is just the street where MARTA buses and cars are just flying by. And even if they're doing the speed limit, you know, if a kid trips and falls in the street, you know, that ends in tragedy. And, you know, as a faculty here at Thomasville, we've talked about doing like what we call a human bus, where tons of faculty just kind of walk as kids are walking to and from school to make sure that they're not, you know, attacked on one side or falling in the street on the other. But also providing the young people in the community something to do in the evenings. Even with, you know, community policing, there are going to be people who decide to kind of come and go into that neighborhood as they so choose, as things stand. And it's not exactly safe for the kids to just be in the common areas playing where, you know, folks are selling drugs or folks may have weapons or folks are doing things that are otherwise illegal. And the Boys and Girls Club is accessible to some of the kids, but it's, say, on the north side of the apartment complex where most of the folks live. And then you've got to get there, which means you've got to go through an open air drug market sometimes. So, you know, it'd be great if kids had something closer where they could go and they could just be kids, whether that's a gym or that's an old fashioned community center. Something like that, or someplace like that, where kids can kind of go and be kids and they don't have to put themselves in danger to get to the safe place.
Mr. Miles, please do keep your millionaire hat on. I'd like to ask that same question again, namely, if you had $1 million and you could spend it this time to improve the health of people in Thomasville Heights, what would you do?
$1 million, huh? Three things. First, I would figure out a way to provide access to mental health services to the folks in the community. I think there's a lot of that going on that is just undiagnosed. I mean, and some of that is just about access, but a lot of that is cultural too. I don't think I'm talking out of turn when I say that, you know, African Americans, Black Americans don't necessarily have the greatest historical relationship with doctors, with medicine in general. And in particular, when it comes to things like depression, substance abuse, you know, we often get told, oh, go to the church. You need Jesus, not you need a therapist. You need someone to, you need talk therapy and medication. So figuring out a way to give the folks access to mental health services, but also figuring out a way to kind of destigmatize seeking mental health services in that community. So that's a biggie. Because if the parents aren't mentally healthy, then the kids aren't. And then that becomes a generational issue. Second is, I think I mentioned earlier that the area is essentially a food desert. The nearest grocery store is maybe a mile away, and a lot of the folks don't have cars. So, you know, I know there's this big urban garden movement in a lot of cities. I was watching something on Netflix. It was Anthony Bourdain's show, and they were in Detroit, and they were looking at all of those overgrown and unused areas and parks and things around the city. And as I walk around this community, there are large swaths of unused just real estate that could easily be turned into some sort of urban garden. And, you know, it wouldn't be something that we would need to provide to people for free. It could be a co-op. It could be run by a nonprofit who, you know, sells the goods at cost. But these folks need access to healthier options. The school does what we can, and I know there are other organizations that do what they can, but, you know, if the nearest thing to you is the local, you know, hot wing spot, and then there's the gas station, you know, and you're a kid and you get $2, you know, you're not going to go buy an apple. You're going to go buy some chips, a soda, because that's what's available. You know, it's not even about what you like. But also, and I think this kind of connects to something I said about safety, but giving people a place where they can take care of their physical health in a safe manner. So whether that is a community center that has, you know, a walking track in there, or a basketball court or tennis courts, or making access to places where you can take care of your health safe for the folks would be important to me. But if I had to prioritize those three, I would do mental health first, access to healthy food second. And I mean, I think if you took care of those two, that physical exercise, that kind of thing, you would naturally roll that in. But that'd be 1, 2, 3 for me.
Mr. Miles, I can tell from talking to you before this interview and also hearing you during the interview that the kids who attend Thomasville Heights Elementary School mean the world to you. I'm sure that you have great dreams for them, dreams and hopes and wishes for them. Tell me, please, about those dreams, and tell me, please, what has to be changed or improved in the community in order for it to be easier for those dreams to come true?
This is kind of a catch-all, but it is something that I think about every single time I come in this building, and when I leave in the evenings, and even before I go to bed at night. And it's that the 500 kids, give or take, who go to school here understand that education for them is not, it shouldn't be about, you know, passing a test or making your teacher happy. And those are great things, but it's about creating options for themselves. I don't know that all of the kids we serve, or their older siblings that we don't serve, or their families who we serve, you know, by virtue of serving them, understand that school is a way to change their life outcomes. And you know, I mentioned earlier, for me, college was kind of a given. you know, based on my parents' experiences, based on that trip to Georgia Tech, based on my experience with my band teacher, college was my next step. But I don't try to limit the kids' options to just that. But I do try to express to them and to their parents every single day that, you know, high school must not be the end for you. You know, Forest Cove, that neighborhood, must not be the end for you. Thomasville Heights, the community, must not be the end for you. You know, you do the world a disservice if you don't take your perspectives, your talents, your gifts, your experiences, if you don't take them outside of 30315. You know, if you just stay between I-285 and I-20, you rob the world of all that you can give it, you know? So I try to communicate to the kids, and I just hope they understand that they have something to offer to the world that is valuable. And, you know, I think it's their responsibility, or I try to teach them that it's their responsibility to give of themselves to the world. And the only way that they can do that is by getting out of, you know, this couple square mile radius.
Mr. Miles, I'm really grateful to you. I'd heard a lot of great things about the school before I came here a couple days ago and started talking with folks, and I've realized just how highly people in the community think about this school. And I'd heard many wonderful things about you as a man and as an administrator. And over the course of this interview and our discussion before, I'm getting some insights why. I'm really grateful to know you, and I'm grateful to have had this chance to sit down with you. I'd like to sign off and say thanks, and the final word is yours.
Thanks for taking the time to come speak with me and allow me to share my experiences here as an administrator and as an educator. And you know, I'm really looking forward to this upcoming school year. I'm looking forward to see what our kids can do, and I really look forward to helping to be a part of the change in this community. So thank you for today.